Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Colts Cover 2 podcast. I am Indy Star Colts insider Jim Aiello, and I am joined, as always, by fellow insider and co-host Joel A. Erickson. And actually, we are joined by a very special guest. I wouldn't say host today, but a guest who's going to know a lot more about Carson Wentz than we do is Jeff McClain, who covered him for years in Philadelphia, and I believe has had some of the best coverage about what's going on in Philadelphia and what went wrong with Carson Wentz during, you know, that last couple of years in Philadelphia. So I'm really excited to have Jeff here to ask him about it. So, Jeff, thanks for joining us.
And thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to set up Joel. Joel, you and I have talked a lot about Carson Wentz, about kind of the thing, what went wrong. But I know you have some questions about kind of the off-field stuff. So fire away, Joel.
Well, Jeff, I actually kind of want to just start with, if you can go back, and I'm sure last season is probably hard to forget, but if you can go back to what you thought of Carson Wentz after the 2019 season, because my understanding from talking to some people on this side of the trade is I think the Colts are pretty optimistic that they're getting that guy and not the guy that played in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if they even talk about the 2017, obviously, because of Frank Reich and his connection to Carson in those first 2 years. And, you know, they do have people there in the building that knew Carson through 2019 and Mike Groh, but that relationship wasn't particularly great. Mike was the offensive coordinator, and you know, they butted heads on a lot of stuff. And, you know, specifically, I think Carson wanted the offense tailored more to his skill set, whereas, you know, I think Mike was trying to do that, but Mike was also trying to devise a game plan that was also built around how, you know, you go up against certain defense, how you attack a certain defense. And they would have a lot of problems. You know, I think Mike tried his hardest to toe the line there and not always be the, you know, quote unquote bad cop that maybe Carson needed. Nevertheless, you know, I'm sure that Mike's evaluation was taken into consideration, and maybe that deterred him a little bit. As you guys know, they didn't really give up a heck of a lot to get Carson Wentz. But all that being said, 2019, I think he was not great in the first 12 games, but down the stretch when they fiddled with things a little bit, they made the offense, they simplified a little bit. There were so many injuries that there were a lot of players that were kind of little known. And maybe when you have certain personalities and certain guys that have been playing in the league a long time, they expect certain things. And I think Carson didn't have to worry about that and just kind of played a little more within himself. And that produced a pretty good stretch of football for him until he had the concussion, you know, 8 plays or 9 plays into the playoff game against the Seahawks. And clearly that had an effect on him emotionally. I mean, obviously physically, he, apparently from what I understand, it was a pretty significant concussion, something that took a little while for him to get over. And he's talked about it in rather serious tones. That being said, you know, last season was a tough one for many, many reasons. Again, they now have someone in the building who's lived through it in Press Taylor. So I don't know how, you know, that again factored into their evaluation or whether they wanted to go through it. But, you know, I'm not sure if I answered your question specifically, but you know, I think that, they want the version of Carson Wentz that Frank Reich had playing at a very high level in 2017 and not the one that was among the worst quarterbacks in 2020.
Is that guy still in there, Jeff? Is that quarterback still, is he still capable of playing that way?
I've spoke to a lot of people around about this very issue, and the general consensus I got was that probably not going to be the 2017 Carson, that 13 game span where many people thought that he played at an MVP level, and for various reasons. I think the knee injury and the back injury, and then you have the concussion and just the way that Carson plays, that he's pretty banged up. He's only 28 years old, and he's still a pretty good athlete. If you watch the film of him even last year, he still makes some pretty spectacular plays. But 2017 was, wow, there were so many of those plays. And, you know, some of that had to do with, you know, coming back off those injuries, typically an ACL, and I think he also had the torn LCL. It takes a while to come back from those. But Carson plays almost like a linebacker or with that mentality. And those various bumps and bruises will accumulate over a period of time. And he's implemented this new program. He didn't, it's not new now, but in 2018, Martini implemented a program that was designed to get him in the best before practices and before games. And a lot of players use it. It was something that he picked up working out with Tom House and Adam Dado, in Southern California. But you know, one thing that some of the people inside the building were kind of questioning was, like, he'd come out to practice like some of that may be old school guys saying, oh, you know, give me the football, twist your arm a little bit and throw it a few and you should be ready to go. But I also felt like there was some concern that maybe physically this was an issue. Does he have something wrong with him? You know, he never went on the injury report during the season. He did miss some time before the start of the season, but you have to wonder if physically Carson could be that guy in 2017. He did show some improvement in various respects in 2018, 2019. His completion percentage went up in both those years. So it wasn't like he was kind of a serious regression in 2018 and 19, but the wow plays weren't there as much. He was still kind of, the mechanics were still an issue, even though the accuracy was going up. Still having a problem with playing a little bit too much hero ball, which is why you still saw a lot of fumbles. You saw a lot of fumbles this season, but you saw a lot of fumbles throughout his entire career. So is it possible for him to get the 2017 guy? Yes. I think more than likely what I've heard from people is like they've 2018-19 is a realistic point of which he could return to.
You've kind of touched on this a couple times already, but is he coachable? Is Carson Wentz coachable?
Yeah, so this was obviously I've done a lot of reporting on this aspect of Carson, and it's something that has always been there with Carson. When the Eagles evaluated him coming out of North Dakota State, that was one of the issues that you maybe have on the con side of the ledger, that he would butt heads with his coaches. Now the Eagles, to some extent, you viewed that as a good thing because you want a guy who cares, you want a guy that's has an informed opinion about stuff, and you want a guy that knows what he wants and is smart enough to voice it. That being said, it can become an issue if you aren't playing at a certain level, right? You know, if you're playing well and you're pointing out the stuff that needs to be done or that you like or don't like, then okay, yeah, it's okay, we'll go with you, Carson. You know, seem to know yourself the best. This is working. But when it wasn't working, and clearly in 2020 it wasn't working, and he wasn't listening enough, and he wasn't looking at the mistakes he made and seeing really them for what they are or agreeing to kind of work on them, that's when it becomes a problem, right? It's that whole, you know, I've described Carson as a hyper type A personality since almost the day I met him or had been around him. And that can be that you can describe a lot of top quarterbacks the same way. I mean, Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, go down the line. Those guys are all type A guys. But that being said, I think they're coachable. They want to be coached hard, right? I think, and I had a quote in my story, I'll paraphrase here, but it's like the best quarterbacks want the best teachers to coach them hard, right? And someone recently told me a story about Tom Brady. When Josh McDaniel went and took the job with the Broncos, you know, Bill O'Brien became the offensive coordinator, basically stepped into the shoes. And I think even before Bill reached out to Tom Brady sent him a text saying, hey, I want to be coached and I want to be coached hard. And that's, I think, what, you know, some of the coaches that have been around a lot of great quarterbacks, Doug Peterson certainly has as well. They wanted that out of Carson. And, you know, it had increasingly become an issue. And maybe, you know, from, I look at it from Carson's perspective, he'd be like, hey, why am I listening to these guys? They're not scheming up things that play to my strength. You know, in terms of the evaluators, they're not giving me certain guys that I need on the field. But I think looking at it objectively and hearing all sides of the issue, I do feel like a lot of it fell more on Carson's plate.
So, Jeff, do you think, is Frank Reich then the coach that maybe just because of his playing experience and the guys that he has coached working with Manning and working with Rivers, is that maybe just where the difference came, was there was maybe more of a respect for Frank versus some of the other guys that he ended up working with, like Mike and Press, and again, obviously not Doug wouldn't maybe fit in there, but some of the other guys.
Right. That's the right follow-up. And I was going to go on further. I knew I was talking too long, but yeah. So the question is whether Frank could be the guy to is Frank the right guy to coach him and coach him hard. So Frank, you guys obviously have gotten to know him probably better than I, we spent two years together. You know, Frank has a way where he can coach guys hard, but, you know, certainly not raising his voice, certainly. Although I don't think there really were guys like that in the Eagles building as well. But, you know, he knows how to love them up as well. And John DeFilippo, who was his quarterback coach the first 2 years, maybe a little harder, but John knows how to, you know, get them to focus too as well. I think maybe that had been overplayed a little bit too. You know, it's funny. I've talked to Frank about this very subject many times and many times just kind of having talking about quarterbacks. And, you know, Frank would, and I, you know, a lot of it had to do with Carson's aggressiveness early on. I thought that was an issue, and it kind of remains an issue, is that why he was getting injured was that, you know, here's this guy that just will do what he does just because that's what he feels like he should do when it's not really within the best interest of the team. And Frank had talked about, I wrote a story about it, and Frank and I talked to Frank at maybe one of the owners meetings, and he had mentioned how maybe you'll tell him, hey, you can't play this well, play this way. And a lot of ways it would go in one ear. I'm paraphrasing what Frank's response was, but it would go in one ear and it went out the other, and who I am sort of thing. And I think they got him to kind of get away from that a little bit in 2017, although he did play certainly aggressive, but he's playing at such a high level, it didn't hurt them as much. And then when Frank went to the Colts, and I think the Eagles and Colts played each other in 2008, and Frank started to say, well, you know, he does have that gene in him, and he can be – and he started to say, call him stubborn, and he stopped himself from calling him – you know. But I know Frank, that's how he felt. Like, Carson could be super stubborn. It's like, you know – And to some extent, it can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing. But I feel like Frank knows how to massage it. And also, you know, I think this plays a little bit into it. They're both fiercely Christian. You know, their faith is very, very important in their lives. Frank, I think, was a pastor or minister at some point. And, you know, I think just judging from what I know, Frank, he kind of walks the walk and talk, and not only just talks the talk. And I think Carson's the same way. And I think there's a certain amount of level of trust because of that.
How do you think Press Taylor and Mike Groh factor into this equation? Obviously them being back on staff. I think I remember reading, it might've been your story, that there were a lot of different quarterback guys on the Eagles staff. There's a ton of quarterback guys on the Colts staff too. Their offensive coordinator, they've hired a new quarterbacks coach in addition to Press and Mike. What about those relationships with Carson?
Groh, who was the wide receivers coach in 2017, did a great job. They won the Super Bowl, got bumped up to offensive coordinator. Doug wanted to keep things in-house. And this was after Frank had kind of left late in the season. So it was tough for him. So that they bumped Mike up. And, you know, Mike had some struggles. He'd never been an NFL coordinator before. And the offense wasn't as good in 2018 and 2019. And, you know, Mike ended up becoming kind of the scapegoat for some of that. His failures. And just to go from Frank into Mike, and look, when Frank left, it was a huge hole, because I think that's Doug and Frank had a great relationship. They trusted each other so much, and they just seemed to be simpatico with how to run that offense. And Mike, you know, had wanted to come in and put his imprint on the offense. And then maybe, you know, when Carson would struggle here and there, there were some curious game planning decisions, don't get me wrong, that were made where you're just like, why are they doing this? And I'm sure Carson felt the same way as well. But then, of course, you'd watch the game like, Carson, what are you doing as well? So I think it went both ways. But, you know, Mike ended up kind of falling under the knife on that. You know, Doug, after last season, had said that Mike was coming back. He said it publicly. He told Mike that he was coming back. And then a day later, they fire him. And that was, you know, after he had meetings with Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman. And when I first reported that, I didn't know for certain whether like, okay, he's got to go or whatever. I think they painted it to him a certain way. And then Doug then made the decision, but they, you know, they were, let's Carson certainly played a role in that as well. I mean, they knew how Carson felt about Mike, and I'm sure Mike felt it as well, and I'm sure Mike still feels it. So it'll be interesting to see if they can patch that up. Now, they're not going to be working necessarily directly in Indianapolis, but they're going to have to communicate. They're going to have to be around each other. We'll see how that goes. You guys, that'll be more of a thing for you to follow. And then with Press Taylor, Press was hired by Chip Kelly, who preceded Doug Peterson. Bottom rung guy came in, but he impressed them and he hung around. And when Doug kind of interviewed a bunch of guys, said, "Hey, I like this kid. I'm going to keep him around." One of the few guys that was a holdover from the previous staff, and impressed both Doug and Frank in his film study. I think one of the things, you guys know how it is. Quality control coaches have to do a lot of the grunt work. But one of the areas that they gave him was like, "Hey, trick plays, gadget plays." And he had since been they've credited him with kind of digging up that play that led to the Philly special in the Super Bowl. And, many fathers to the success of that play, but Press, digging it up and saying, "Hey, maybe this is something that could play to our strengths," was something that they had given him credit for. And then when John DeFilippo left after the Super Bowl, they bumped Press up to quarterbacks coach. And I think at the time, a lot of people were like, "Okay, not a bad idea. Makes sense." Right. But I think at the time they were a little concerned about this internally. And over time you realize that maybe this is a problem. This is a guy that's only maybe 5 years senior of Carson. When Carson came in, they were kind of almost on a equal playing ground, even if it's player and coach. And they were friends. I always like to tell the anecdote. I think their dogs have the same mother. Like, they were buddies, right? So that can be a problem if you have the guy who he's reporting to directly and spending the most amount of time with. If he's not going to call him out on stuff that needs to be called out on, then that's going to be a problem. And I think Press has a different way of coaching. And again, this is a young guy who hadn't really kind of been coaching at this level for very long. He'd never been a quarterback's coach before. He played quarterback in college and had done enough to impress people, but I don't think they knew really how he'd be as a quarterback's coach. And I think what I found out over this year, increasingly so, was that Press just wasn't calling out Carson on stuff. And if he kind of alluded to it, Carson would just ignore it, or just, he wasn't being pressed enough on stuff. And that became an issue, according to a lot of people in the building that I had spoke to. They perceived it. Now, maybe it wasn't entirely Press's fault. He was being tossed into a very difficult position. They added pass game coordinator to his duties last season, which essentially was a lot of the stuff that Mike Rowe did as offensive coordinator. But, I mean, so, Frank told me this at the combine after Press had been promoted to quarterback's coach. That he said, I remember people were like, "Oh, this is tampering," but he said that, if it was up to him, he would have taken Press. He really liked Press a lot. I don't know what that says about Frank's evaluating skills, that Press wouldn't be a good quarterback. It wasn't good for Carson. For Press, maybe he can become a good quarterback's coach. But Frank felt enough about him to hire him here. They share the same agent, so make of that of what you will. But it seems like it's just going to be kind of what they call him, a senior offensive consultant. It seems like he's going to be film study guy. He's going to be kind of looking at, he's not going to have a direct contact problem.
So from Carson's side, going into this offseason a little bit, they fired Doug Peterson. It seemed like, again, this is just the impression from Indy we got, was that, "Hey, it'd be great to bring Frank Reich back. We can't do that. Let's bring his other study in, and that'll appease Carson Wentz." That's the way it felt from Indianapolis. I don't know if that was true, but when did it become apparent to you and in Philadelphia that Carson was, again, I don't think he ever formally requested a trade, but was done in Philadelphia?
Yeah, formally requested. I mean, whatever. Can you formally request? Is there a paper you have to fill out? I'm formally requesting. I don't want to play here, and I prefer to play in Indianapolis, yeah. But I'm not asking to be traded. I mean, yeah. He wanted to be traded. He hasn't said it publicly, but from so many different sources, I now know for a fact that it was something that he wanted. And the reports first surfaced in December after he was benched. what I had found out increasingly, and when I wrote my story in January, that kind of went in more in detail, I feel like than pretty much most of the stuff that people have been writing about him at that time, about what had happened this past season. I didn't know exactly how disillusioned Carson had been with the Eagles early last season. Now, clearly he wasn't happy about the trade for Jalen Hurts, second round pick for a quarterback, less than a year after he just signed a $128 million contract extension. And I think what I was told was he came in the camp, he wasn't happy about the Jalen Hurts stuff, but again, a lot of what happened with the pandemic played into, no spring practices, no chance to really meet Jalen and spend time with him. It just created this very awkward dynamic very early at practice and the meetings when they were able to kind of meet at the NovaCare complex. So that just kind of added to Carson's psyche and how he felt about the whole situation. And in turn, it just affected his confidence when he just started to struggle. And when you had issues on the offensive line early and maybe the, injuries here and there. And then you also had the rookies not really developing, as fast as the Eagles had hoped. And then you have certainly the play calling was an issue and all the weird dynamic of the coaching staff. This is kind of just, became a domino effect that just led to Carson becoming more and more despondent and anxious about the situation as time progressed. And then of course you get to, so he was not happy for a while. And then obviously then to get benched. And, I'm sure he's confident in himself and felt like he shouldn't have got benched. Everyone in the world saw it. It was very clear. It should have happened probably weeks earlier where Doug gave him every opportunity to not be benched. I'm not an economist. I try my best not to form opinions about people or things or, I report and I try and base my analysis on reporting. And so, should Carson have allowed his people to put it out there, I think we can come to the conclusion that's pretty much where those reports were coming from. Did he know it? Who knows? But it's understandable. I mean, who would want to come back and compete after you've been the starter for so long and you performed at a certain level? Do you want to play with this guy now hanging over your shoulder in one of the toughest sports cities to play? So you can understand where he is coming from. I mean, I kind of understand it myself. I think some people thought that, we'd heard about the relationship with Doug Peterson and Carson wasn't good. And, I think there had been reports that they hadn't spoken for almost as 2 months. That's not the case from what I understand. And it is impossible. They were talking obviously during games and they would meet during install meetings, but the relationship clearly was I wouldn't say fractured. There was no clear break, maybe a splinter is the word that I would use. And it had been going in that direction, but when he was benched, SI reported, I didn't have this, but it was reported via text message. And I think they texted a few times after that and just, they didn't talk for that final month. So they fired Doug Peterson. And I don't think that was because of Carson. I think maybe that was a factor into it as well. I think the Eagles thought maybe there was still a chance. I'm talking about Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman thought that there was still a chance that they could keep Carson Wentz. But I think also Carson didn't know exactly how the Colts situation was going to play out. I'm sure his agents knew that maybe there's a chance and they were given the opportunity to kind of shop Carson. But once you give them that opportunity, I think that's pretty much where, as long as you can find one team and you can get back enough in compensation and the Eagles are convinced that they need to do this as well, that's where this was going. They knew that he was unhappy. They kind of gave him, Carson gave him the reasons why, I prefer to play elsewhere. The Eagles then had kind of look at it from their situation. It certainly would benefit them now versus later to make, in terms of the salary cap, it doesn't benefit them overall. They're going to take a huge cap hit this year, dead money cap hit this year. But if they did it now versus, next year or whatever, does that make sense for them financially? Do they really want this quarterback controversy hanging over them all throughout the year? So it got to a point where they felt like, all right, this was within our best interest as well.
I guess, obviously you're not a columnist, but just knowing Carson, Do you think Carson can overcome some of his hyper type A personality, which it sounds like went wrong a little bit or a lot of it in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I mean, if you can channel it in the right direction. Look, I think, again, I know you guys are talking to me about a lot of stuff maybe happened off the field or, you know, in the locker room, et cetera. I don't think that's Carson's biggest issue. I think Carson's biggest issue is he's got to perform on the field. And, you know, I think even I wrote in the story, I felt like he could have turned it around with his teammates. If you win, right? If you win, that's all that matters. All these other issues. And again, Carson's not a bad guy, right? He's not even a bad teammate. He's not a bad teammate. For the most part, he's a good team. Now, you're a quarterback, though, and a lot more is expected out of you. And that's maybe where he struggled a little bit. And then the dynamic of just there's no way anybody could have predicted this. And to go back and look upon what happened to him is remarkable. He plays at MVP level. He tears his knee up and suffers a season-ending injury. Does anyone recall that he threw a touchdown on a torn ACL in that game, the game in which they clinched home field advantage throughout the entire playoffs? You know, I hate to lose perspective there because Carson was a hero there at this point. And then, of course, Nick Foles comes in, and that was a great team. And he didn't really particularly play great early on, but then all of a sudden he just kind of got the ball rolling and just played at a super high level from the NFC Championship on and won the Super Bowl. And, geez, you know, I was in the locker room. I sat there and followed Nick the entire time and was watching Carson and Carson down on kneeling at his stall. And later on, I asked him, well, what were you saying to yourself? He's like, I'm praying that I wouldn't become jealous of Nick and my teammates for winning the Super Bowl without me and that I would have the chance to get back. I mean, and then to come back and then he suffers the back injury and Nick steps in again, leads him to the playoffs, gets him to the second round and with one drop pass from getting back to the NFC Championship. And then again, to suffer a season ending concussion. So this is a lot for Carson to have to deal with. And then they draft Jalen Hurts, which I, to this day, don't understand why they would have done so. And you know what? You can say shame on Carson for allowing it to affect him, but he's only human. And considering everything that he had just been previously through, you can kind of understand why mentally he wasn't completely all the way there. And being a type A guy, to not be in control of a situation like that when you thought maybe these guys had your back, I think you can understand why he went down that path. Now, again, he's got to strengthen up. He's got to get back to being the confident Carson that he can be. And, you know, you want him to be that kind of type A guy, but you don't want him to kind of isolate. You don't want him to kind of get too within himself. You don't want him, again, to be butting heads with coaches all the time and become to the point where he's uncoachable. I think playing in a city with more of a Midwest mentality, the microscope isn't as large. There isn't as narrow on him. Will maybe allow him to kind of work through maybe weeks when he isn't playing that well. Philadelphia is a pressure cooker, and it's tough to really play here, especially if you're the quarterback of the Philadelphia Eagles.
So, Jeff, I appreciate all your time. Last thing I have for you was that you mentioned Jalen, and I was just curious. I mean, again, the Colts drafted a guy last year, Jacob Eason, not a second rounder, fourth rounder, but a guy the Colts like. And I was, you know, curious if things start to struggle. If he starts to struggle a little bit, Carson, I mean, in the first few weeks, do you think he'll have that tendency to maybe look behind him? Because obviously it happened with Foles, it happened with Jalen. I don't think Jacobs is as big a threat as those two guys were, but just curious, if things don't get off to a great start with Carson in the first few weeks, will he have that kind of reflex to look behind him?
That's interesting. I haven't really yet thought about that. I guess for you guys, obviously that plays into what you have to be looking at. I mean, he had Nick looking over, you know, he had the Nick thing and he had the Jalen thing. I don't think this is as great. So I don't think there is as much of a threat. And, you know, the contract really only, you know, obviously they have to pay for 2 years of guaranteed salary, but it's not like they're required to have him beyond just this year. But I think it's enough where Carson should feel comfortable in his own shoes. And Frank should be patient enough to give him time to kind of work through maybe, you know, learning. And, you know, Carson's really big. You guys are going to hear this a lot about him from him. He's big on, like, you know, the chemistry, working with receivers and developing that. No one works as hard as Carson. He's first in, last out. No one will ever question him on his diligence and his dedication to his craft. I think you know, that's something you'll see with him. And look, he made the effort to work with, you know, to try and reach certain corners of the locker room. Maybe, you know, sometimes not as much as certain teammates had hoped. He kind of, when he would struggle or he would be focused on one thing versus another thing, it struggled. He just wasn't, he's not a very gregarious type of personality. He can be kind of a little bit withdrawn, a little bit standoffish. I don't want to say again, Carson, my interactions with him were almost like 100% positive. So, you know, I never had any issue with him, and I felt like he was always a professional with us. He's not really completely open. And I think, well, not just with the media, but more importantly, with maybe all of his teammates. And, you know, whereas Nick Foles is the kind of got this just gregarious type of personality where everyone just gravitates toward him. I don't think Carson's the type of person where guys will necessarily gravitate to him. But in terms of the backup, you know, as long as Frank is willing to kind of, you know, trust him, it's, you know, it seems like it's the ideal situation for Carson Wentz. I mean, if there's a real winner in this, it's really Carson, because he gets an opportunity to redo his career in a place that's seemingly set up for him to do so.
That feels like a perfect place to end. Jeff, I really can't say thank you enough. That was fantastic.
Yeah, much appreciated. I appreciate you taking the time out to
say thanks for having me with Carson.
All right, thanks. Like I said, you guys should all follow Jeff on Twitter if you can. It's great follow on Twitter for Eagles and beyond that stuff. So @Jeff_McClain. Thanks again, Jeff. Hey guys, we just wrapped up the interview with Jeff. We're starting kind of segment two of the Colts Cover 2 podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. I know the sound was a little bit wonky. It was a little bit kind of fuzzy on Jeff's end a little bit, and we just kind of due to time constraints and hoping that you guys could kind of make out most of it. I think most of it was clear, but apologize for that. But like I said, hope you guys caught all of it, and we're going to break it down. Like Joel and I were excited about talking to Jeff. We have been for about a week now, and now we're excited. We're just going to go first reactions. I mean, we just recorded this a few minutes ago, and now we're just going to go kind of what we heard Jeff say about Carson Wentz. And again, a guy I would consider an expert on the Eagles. So Joel, we just talked to Jeff. What was your main number one takeaway, I guess, from what Jeff told us about Carson?
One of the main takeaways is that I think that in other places, I wouldn't say like in Jeff's reporting, but I would say in other places that it's been sort of played up, this idea that the Colts hired Press Taylor to sort of connect, like to help, I guess, lure Carson Wentz here. Obviously some of the stuff we just heard from Jeff about maybe Taylor wasn't ready to push Carson Wentz. One of the things that stuck out to me is that both Press Taylor and Mike Groh, the two people who were on the Eagles staff, and there's been some question about how they worked with Carson, one on the one side with Groh and then one on the other side with Taylor. Neither of those guys are really going to be directly in those same types of relationships this time around. Press Taylor is a senior offensive assistant. We have not talked to Frank Reich yet, but based on what we know of the way he set his staff up in the past, I would assume that you know, Jeff's inklings are right, and Press Taylor is going to be more on the film game planning side of things, building stuff, helping find stuff. I don't know that he's going to be working that closely with Wentz in terms of his mechanics and stuff like that. Groh is the wide receivers coach now. And I think Colts fans know this. They have like four quarterbacks coaches.
Yeah, right.
Frank Reich is, as a head coach, is a quarterbacks coach. Their offensive coordinator, Marcus Brady, is a quarterbacks coach. They hired Scott Milanovich to be a quarterbacks coach. Mechanics-wise, Gerard Johnson being offensive quality control is worth mentioning here. Because that's what he did, was taught college kids mechanics before he came on. And then obviously they just promoted Parks Frazier to assistant quarterbacks coach. So there's a lot of quarterbacks coaches before you even get to those two Eagles guys. And it sounds like, again, maybe we talk to Frank Reich tomorrow and I end up finding out that they're, one of them is going to have more of an influence. But I don't think that some of the stuff you heard about how he worked with Groh and how he worked with Taylor applies to here. I think it applies there, as Jeff was really talking about what it was like there. I don't know if it applies as much here because I don't know how much direct work they're going to have with him.
Yeah, I mean, what we do know is about the way Frank works, right? It's a super collaborative thing. Like you talk about coming up with plays and the Jacoby package, and I talked to him at length about that last year. It was, we're getting input from Nick and from Marcus and from Jason Michael and from me and from, we're watching film. Like he believes very deeply in the collaborative process. So I think those guys will be involved a little bit, but I think to your point, they're not going to be asking a guy like Press Taylor now here in Indianapolis to do the thing that Jeff said was maybe a struggle, which was their buddies pointing out the mistakes that Carson was making on tape and saying, you need to address it this way or address it that way. And maybe Carson wasn't ready to hear that, or they, you know, according to Jeff, he kind of just shook it off and said, yeah, okay, whatever. Or he made excuses about it. Well, if that dynamic doesn't work, to your point, it doesn't really matter because that's not what Press Taylor is going to be doing. Mike Groh, as a wide receivers coach, won a championship with Carson Wentz and Nick Foles in 2017. That's what Mike Groh was doing in Philadelphia in 2017. So that, I mean, we've seen that work, right? And with Frank Reich.
And I think one thing, I don't mean to cut you off here, but one thing that just occurred to me and I wanted to jump before we switch to a different topic is Mike Groh's presence as wide receivers coach becomes even more important this year because Nick Sirianni left. Nick Sirianni as an offensive coordinator has always been a wide receivers coach.
Yeah.
So they had two people kind of in that role, whereas now it's mostly quarterbacks guys on that side of the ball. And so the Mike Groh's role as receivers coach is doubly important, I think, now that Nick Sirianni is gone, just because that's Nick's background. Nick's background is working with receivers. Again, didn't mean to cut you off, just popped into my head.
No, it's a good point. Actually, Jason Michael is gone, and that was the guy that, well, if you talk to Zach Pascal, he said Jason Michael has a huge influence on the things that he did. And so there was a guy that he knew from Tennessee and kind of their background together. But again, like, you're right. They lost some of that wide receiver power that they had before. So Groh is going to be very focused on that. And to your point, like, I think the two main offensive voices in the room where they were with Frank and Nick Sirianni, now it's going to be Marcus Brady and Frank Reich. So I want to talk, one of the other things that kind of did jump out to me was that it seemed like Frank Reich, at least according to Jeff, and Jeff knows, you know, Frank in relation to Carson, as opposed to us, we're just going to get to know that, how that dynamic works. But it sounded like it worked really well, like that Carson maybe, and this maybe comes from Frank Reich's background as a player. It's funny that he brought that up a little bit because when I talked to Frank Reich about Peyton Manning recently, he said that was kind of, there's an inherent respect, like right off the bat. And again, you kind of talk about similar personalities, type A personality with Peyton Manning, type A personality with Carson Wentz, guys who are very demanding, guys who want kind of do things the way they want to do them. Well, they're willing to take input from guys they respect. And Frank Reich immediately had that respect with Peyton Manning. He's obviously had that respect with Carson Wentz, given his background and the way he coaches. So I think if there's hope for a rebound, and a lot of people said, yeah, Carson Wentz and Frank Reich, that's the reason why everything's going to work. Well, I think if you go a little deeper into that, it's because Frank maybe has a line to Carson's mind that other coaches didn't.
There's a quote that I've come back to a bunch over the last couple of years, and it's from Frank's wife, Linda. And I'm paraphrasing here. I don't have it right in front of me, but it's from a story I wrote on him when I was writing about his time as a pastor. And essentially she said that Frank's real gift is unearthing the best in other people. And people who are like that, people who are very, very good at that, are people who are good at understanding what sort of motivation and what buttons need to be pressed. I've seen Frank described as a medium cop somewhere. I think Peter King. we've talked about it before on this podcast, but Frank Reich is not like a fire and brimstone, scream at you, belittle you type of coach. There are some of those in the NFL. He's not one of them. Frank is more of a guy that you just inherently don't want to disappoint. Because there's something about Frank Reich that just commands respect. And I've heard that from people from his past. I've heard that from people with the Colts. I've heard that from his boss with the Colts. Jim Irsay has said that there's an inherent level of respect that goes to Frank. And I think that probably goes a long way towards that gift that Linda was talking about when I was doing that story, that he, part of it is there's an inherent respect. Like Frank just sort of commands respect. And when somebody is like that, you're more likely to listen to them, I think, than other people. So obviously I think that that's one thing that stuck out to me. And Jeff definitely alluded to that, right. If you're paying attention from a Frank Reich perspective, Jeff was sort of alluding to that through the whole thing. Anyway, he said like Frank and Doug Peterson were simpatico in that offensive coordinator head coach relationship. Like Frank's really good at this. He's really good at building relationships. There's no stories that you're going to go find on Google. If you try to Google Frank Reich rift quarterback or something like that, I'm not going to lie. I've tried multiple times. You're not going to find it.
It's actually funny that you bring that up. I mean, this is me doing research for Peyton Manning's story and digging into Frank Reich a little bit, and his role with the Bills back when he was the backup quarterback there, it was a story that Vic Carucci wrote, was that he was kind of the mediator. Like Jim Kelly had this kind of big personality and at times would upset, you know, a guy, again, if Thurman Thomas wasn't getting the ball as much, or was it Andre Rison? Reed.
Reed.
Reed, sorry. Andre Reed wasn't getting the ball as much. He'd get frustrated or something like that. Frank would go talk to them. And it wasn't like it was interesting. It wasn't like Frank, like he, you know, Jim Kelly or Marv Levy told him to go do it. It was just something he figured he should do because that's what the backup quarterback does. He plays mediator and he builds these relationships. And he says, you know, hey, we didn't get you here, but I was in the meeting with Jim and he wants to get you the ball the next week doing this and that. And like, he was great at trying to mend those personalities and mesh them, I should say, when things went wrong. So again, I think this speaks to, maybe if Carson Wentz had trouble, I don't know, taking coaching from certain guys, that's not Frank Reich's issue, as you pointed out. Frank Reich is really good at finding a way to connect with everybody.
I also think it's important to not, I think there's a tendency among football fans or people who follow football, me included, into thinking of people who yell as disciplinarians.
Right.
And people who don't as people who are just going to kind of be wishy-washy. But there have been several stories over the years that there is a breaking point with Frank Reich. I'm sort of fascinated by this and would love to like see the examples. But like there was a story that Howard Mudd told about when Frank was just starting out on staff and Howard had been giving him crap and Frank kind of let into him a little bit.
Yeah.
He finally mad and kind of let into him a little bit. Frank, I jokingly asked him a question about trash talking. And he said any trash talking he ever did was angry trash talking. There's a side to Frank Reich that is a little more steely than I think he's always portrayed. And it's hard to find it, but I think if you pay attention, you can see it. The one I always think about is the joint practices a couple years ago at the Browns. The Colts offensive line was getting beaten pretty badly. And it wasn't like a scream or a yell. It was just a what are we doing, guys? And there's a quality to it that's like, this person is very upset.
Actually, the angry one, like as a player, all I can hear is like Frank, the most I can picture Frank doing is like, you know what, number 82, you're not a very nice person, is about the most I could.
It's like, you know, If NFL Films has the video of Frank Reich angry trash talking, I don't know what I would pay for it, but it's a lot.
We did hear, remember one time it was, gosh, I can't remember what game it was, but the referee had forgot to turn his mic off when he was going over to the sideline, and you could hear Frank going four times. He did it like four times, and it was hilarious. And I was like, man, I think that's the most I've ever heard, like most fired up I've ever heard Frank Reich. And it makes me mad right now that I never asked him about what he was referring to four times. It was like the first play of the game, so I kind of lost track of it. But anyway, you don't hear him get fired up very often. But to your point, I don't think you need to be a yelling, screaming guy to be the disciplinarian or the bad cop or whatever. Yeah.
There's more steel to Frank, I think, than people give him credit for, given some of his background and the way he generally carries himself genially as a nice, you know, he's a very nice person. But I think, and I think Jeff alluded to that as well in terms of how they got along. He also said, I also thought one of the interesting things there was that Jeff kind of pushed back against some of the stuff I've seen from national writers. Like Peter King said that Doug Peterson was the good cop, Frank Reich was the medium cop, and John DeFilippo was the bad cop. And if McLean said that, or Jeff was saying that That's a little bit not true about DeFilippo.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what he said.
It's a little bit of an exaggeration with Flip.
Well, right now, I'll tell you this. I love Peter King, but he's dead to me for at least a week because he led his Colts thing with Andrew Luck. So,
Yeah, I agree with that.
He's got sources with the Colts. We know that. He's friendly with Frank Reich and things like that. But, boy, I was like, come on. Like, I don't think that was ever actually an option. But maybe they did reach out and say, hey, before we make any of these moves, are you super, super duper sure that you're not coming back? But I don't know. He's retired, and I was mad that it got brought back.
I actually don't think that happened because we didn't ask Chris about this, but Chris went on Dan Dockich's radio show and said explicitly, when I talk to him, I'm not like begging him to come back.
I mean, maybe again, there's part of me that thinks Chris would do like a feel it out thing. Like, okay, does this guy sound like he's itching to get back or does he not, without having to ask the question directly kind of a thing. But it was never an option. So anyway, one of the other things that you and I think we talked about, this is funny, we haven't gotten to it yet, but one of the things that jumped out to us, and I think this is the overarching theme of this, was none of the off-field stuff will matter if he wins, if the Colts win, because winning kind of cures everything. And you talk about these type A personalities, and Jeff brought this up specifically, and you and I talked about it even before we talked to Jeff, which was, you know, the guys that have those type A personalities that are sometimes hard to deal with for teammates or coaches or things like that are the guys that are some of the best quarterbacks, like Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers. Like, some of these guys do have those very type A personalities that are hard to deal with sometimes, and no one cares. And the players figure it out how to work around them because they're winners and they win Super Bowls and they're incredible. If Carson Wentz gets back to old Carson Wentz, whether that's 2019 form, 2017 form, but if he gets back to that and the Colts are winning, I don't think there's going to be any reports of discord in the locker room with a guy like Carson Wentz because they're winning. And that usually makes everyone feel good.
I also think that some of the teammate stuff has been overblown. And Jeff said the same thing. Jeff wrote the story essentially that I thought was the best story that anyone's done on like what went on behind the scenes in Philadelphia. But Jeff was saying Carson Wentz is not a bad teammate. And I've seen this from other people. Malcolm Jenkins, I think, is one of the people who was sort of touched as a lightning rod for like he'd criticized him. And I was reading something from Malcolm Jenkins. He was on Chris Long's podcast and they were talking about Carson Wentz as a teammate. And both of them were like, he's not a bad teammate. He doesn't it's not necessarily as easy for him personality wise to connect with all corners of the locker room. And I wanted to bring that up because I might be talking out of turn here. I don't think Andrew Luck connected very easily with all parts of the locker room while he was here. And the reason I say that the reported reason I would say that is just that when he came back or when he was talking about Jacoby at some point in I can't remember if it was retirement or before then, he was saying that one of the things that happened to him when he came back was that he was a little bit jealous of Jacoby because of how easy it was for Jacoby to make such good relationships with, it seemed like, everybody on the team.
Right.
So I don't think I'm reading too much into that. I don't necessarily know that. I know for a fact, and I think everyone knows for a fact, that Drew Brees does not necessarily connect with all parts of his locker room and hasn't for a while. Does it matter? Not really for football purposes, because it's Drew Brees and there's a respect there and he wins. Same thing with Andrew. Andrew played hurt. He played hard and he did what he had to do. So I think if you see that stuff, I don't necessarily know that stuff's going to matter as much. I think it matters maybe more in the sense of the Eagles, in terms of there was somebody there who did that in Nick Foles. Foles got an opportunity to play and obviously won Super Bowl there. It was a little bit of a different thing, but I don't necessarily know that I think if you're a good teammate and you try to connect with all corners of the locker room, even if it's not perfect, I think you're probably okay. Like that's just in terms of Brees, like having a season covering Phillip Rivers and then three seasons and change covering Brees. The Colts love Phillip Rivers to a man far more than I ever heard like other positions talk about how much they love Drew. You know, there was the Uncle Phil thing and the trash talk, and there was just like an easy, That's one of Philip Rivers' gifts, is being able to connect with a lot of people. I don't necessarily know that that's true for somebody like Drew. I don't necessarily know that that's true for some of the other quarterbacks that we talked about. What matters is like how you're playing on the field.
It's a great point. Actually, one of the things I never actually get to write in a story, but when I talked to Charlie Whitehurst about Philip Rivers, that's one of the things he brought up, was that Philip Rivers somehow connects with every corner of the locker room. And he makes a point of it. Honestly, I think it's easy for him. He's kind of an outgoing, fun personality that I think he finds something that he can connect with everybody on. And guys like Carson Wentz and Andrew Luck, to your point, aren't necessarily guys like that. I think we all know, I mean, to bring it back to your point about Andrew Luck, like, I don't think anybody disliked him in the locker room, but I don't think he was also the kind of guy that was, you know, hanging out with all the receivers and the CBs and the linebackers and all those, like, at different times, you know?
I don't know that anyone ever wrote a story about the way he connects with people, the way we wrote a bunch of those stories about Jacoby.
Right. No, I mean, I agree. And again, we know he was very tight with like Anthony Costanzo and some other, you know, Jack Doyle and some guys that were, I don't know. Like I said, he did have good relationships in there, but again, I don't think he was like the best friend of all 53 guys. So I'm with you. I don't think you need to be either. That's one way of doing it. And Carson Wentz apparently does it a different way, which actually kind of brings us up to some of the things he said about the football field, Carson Wentz, which I thought was interesting, because I thought I heard a lot of Andrew Luck in there a little bit, which was like a lot of, he called it hero ball, which I don't know if it's fair, but it's a lot of like Carson Wentz trying to extend plays and make plays downfield and doing things a little bit outside of scheme that like, that are outside of the plan that, you know, and that coaches maybe drive him crazy sometimes or things like that. I think Andrew Luck did a lot of that early in his career, especially, and tried to make big plays. And again, I'm not saying there's like a hero tendency. I just think that's the way he played.
There was a sentence that Jeff used there that people absolutely used about Andrew when I first got here. And I'm sure used for a long time before I got here. He said he's got a tendency to play quarterback like a linebacker.
Yes.
I don't know how many times people said that about Andrew.
100%. And again, you know what? I was like, oh, that's a kind of a relief, I think, as a Colts fan, because Frank Reich kind of coached that out of him. For the most part, like there wasn't as much of him running around and getting hit. He wasn't scrambling as much. He was operating within the system and not trying to extend plays too much. Like I think we saw that. I think Luck helped, like his time to throw was definitely down with Frank Reich versus what it had been in earlier his career.
There was a play not long after I started covering the beat, because I started covering the Colts with 11 games to go in what ended up being Andrew's final season. And there was a play that they were in the red zone. It was a game they were winning. Andrew scrambled and he was, I think that like the 5 or the 6, and he just ran out of bounds instead of taking a hit.
Yeah.
Everybody who'd been covering Andrew for longer than I have was like, oh my God, I can't believe he did that.
Yeah.
Like it was a story. Like I think people wrote stories on it afterwards because it was such a difference from the way he played previously. And actually I think if I'm remembering right, like some of the stuff that Jeff was saying about the way Frank tried to get through to Andrew or Carson Wentz is the same stuff that got through to Andrew was, hey, if you want to keep playing, you got to stop playing quite like this and take those chances when it warrants it. So I felt this way about the Andrew Luck Carson Wentz comparison for a while. And I know people are going to hate me for that, but I'm just going to keep steering into this because I think it's true.
I don't think Carson's like, again, if you're just talking, like, I don't think Carson Wentz's peak was ever as high quite as Andrew Luck's, or at least for not as consistently long. Like Carson Wentz had
17 was.
Yeah, it was. It was really good. But again, some of the numbers are a little misleading. I feel like he's got a real wide gap touchdown interception ratio. And then other numbers are good, but they're not exceptionally great.
True. But also he also had 3 seasons of 7 interceptions that Andrew would do 7 interceptions in 3 games. If you let
him. I'm not the same quarterback. I'm just saying, right. I think Andrew Luck's peak was probably better and longer than Carson Wentz's.
Andrew's is from when he got into the league until 2014, those 3 straight 11 and 5 seasons. I think that's a long peak.
Yeah. And I think Carson Wentz has similar upside. They're built similarly. They're physically, like I said, they're both tall, huge quarterbacks that can move, big arms, big brains too. I mean, again, I know that's one of those things that people don't talk about a lot with Carson Wentz, but he is a really, really smart quarterback, and can do a lot of those things. So Actually, I think there's a lot of similarities between those guys. They're not identical, but I think there are similarities. But again, well, which I think speaks well to the hope that Frank Wright can get the best out of Carson Wentz.
Well, and I wrote this the day of the trade happened. Like some of Andrew's, like some of the things he wasn't perfect at is stuff that Carson Wentz has struggled with, and Wright got more out of him. I think we talked about it on the last podcast. Andrew Luck was a particularly accurate passer by NFL standards until Frank Wright coached him. That was the only time in his career he was over 65%, which at this point in the NFL is essentially a baseline.
Right.
Obviously, the sack thing. He took way too many sacks. That's why he's not the quarterback now.
Yep.
And that's where you started with the whether it's hero ball, trying to do too much, playing like a linebacker, however you want to say that.
Yeah.
Part of the reason he took too many sacks. The one thing that Wright didn't really fix with Andrew, but did fix with Phillip Rivers is the interceptions. Wentz was not an interception guy up until this season. Obviously, he was a terrible interception guy this season in 2020. I don't want to minimize that. But this is what we were all talking about with Rivers, not at this time last year because they hadn't signed him yet, but about a month from now last year, was can he not throw interceptions? We were still talking about it after the fifth game. And then he threw six the rest of the way, you know?
Right.
So what I think one of the reasons that I'm interested and optimistic about Carson Wentz in Indianapolis is that Frank Reich has already shown beyond his relationship with Carson Wentz with other quarterbacks that he can fix some of the things that were the biggest issues with Carson on the field.
No, I totally agree. That is the biggest reason to be optimistic. And it is, like I said, you've seen good, again, you've seen this relationship, this exact relationship work before. And then you've seen in the subsequent years, Frank Wright kind of fixing other guys and getting the best out of them. So I think there's definitely the reason to be optimistic. To get back to kind of some of the things that Jeff said. One of the things I want to talk about was, again, Jalen Hurts. And I guess I want to talk about confidence because I think Carson Wentz, one of the biggest issues I've seen with him so far, watching last year and then watching film now, is that it seemed to just go off the rails for him a little bit. I think the mechanics are still a problem. I think that can be fixed. But I think confidence is definitely some part of it. And again, I think that it's partly like, I don't have confidence in my coaches and therefore I don't have confidence in myself. I don't have confidence in my offensive line and my weapons, and therefore I don't have confidence in myself and I'm trying to make things happen. And then he starts to lose confidence in himself because things aren't going well and he's throwing interceptions and then he gets benched. And like, I think this was this spiral for him that kind of, and then there was Jalen Hurts. Sorry. I forgot that other thing. There was always that guy behind him lurking like, hey, maybe they should play this guy. Maybe why aren't they using the Jalen Hurts package? Are they trying to protect Carson Wentz? They were asking a lot of these questions. And I don't know that you can say that Carson Wentz was like fragile, but there were a lot of things going wrong at once that I think maybe sapped the confidence that he once had in himself or his team or any of that stuff. So I'm curious as to how, I think a reset makes a lot of sense for him going to Indianapolis where the offensive line will be better. The weapons will be better. He's got Frank Reich. I do wonder if he struggles, will those confidence issues crop back up? I don't think Jacob Eason is the threat that Jalen Hurts was, just given on, you know, where they were pick wise, Jalen Hurts being a second round pick and Eason being a fourth rounder. But I am curious, is like, if he struggles, do you worry about like the precipitous fall in confidence and that leading to bad play?
Well, I think, and this plays into it, I think one thing that I've seen a lot of people say nationally that I don't necessarily agree with is that it's going to be a lot easier on Carson Wentz here in Indianapolis. I don't think that's true. I think Colts fans have a very high bar for quarterback play. I think in general, the beat covering the Colts has a high bar for quarterback play.
I disagree with this, by the way. I can't wait to rebut because this is interesting.
Well, I'm just thinking about like Phillip Rivers played five games this year, and like people were seriously talking about did he need to be benched.
That's true.
And they were 3-2 at the time. Granted, he had not played well against Jacksonville. He had played terribly in the second half against Cleveland. But that's pretty – like, Phillip Rivers has been like, Phillip Rivers himself said, I read everything everybody wrote, and y'all were pretty honest about it. And I think part of that is because we are, as writers, I think we are affected by the way the fan base is responding to a game. I think Colts fans spent, 25 years watching two quarterbacks they loved?
Yeah.
Pretty much unconditionally.
Right.
And so to win over that fan base, I think, is harder than maybe people are recognizing nationally. I don't think Indianapolis is Philadelphia. I don't think that's true. But I think in terms of the way the quarterback plays, I think there's a really high bar for a quarterback here.
I agree with everything you said. But here's where I somebody asked me this question, is how will Indianapolis feel about Wentz if he struggles? Obviously, they'll be upset. Obviously, we'll see some of the stuff with Rivers. My gut on that, though, is that that'll fall more on the head of Frank Reich. I think a lot of the vitriol and anger will go to the Colts as an organization for picking Carson Wentz. If it doesn't work out, again, this is if things go bad, it'll go more toward Frank and Chris for going, this is our guy. We gave up second and third round assets for it. Like, that's a lot more than they had to give Philip Rivers, which is $25 million off the street. Not a big deal. Second and third round picks, or first and third round picks, depending on what happens. Frank saying, this is my guy, even though he had a terrible 2020 season, I can fix him. If it doesn't work out, I feel like he might be the shield for Wentz a little bit and take on a lot more of that angst in this.
Well, I definitely agree with that. We already saw that last season with Rivers. A lot of what people were saying about Rivers early on was, I can't believe we paid $25 million for this. And a lot of it was, you know, is Reich being too loyal to Rivers, that kind of thing. And the other thing is, you are absolutely right about Frank being the shield, because even if that's not happening, Frank Reich will put himself there.
Exactly.
That's what he will do if it doesn't start out well. Frank Reich will put himself in the firing line, which is, you know, we can debate all day whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. I tend to think it's a good thing. Jim Irsay thinks it's a good thing. I think maybe the more cynical way to look at it is, it's a bad thing for your career.
Do that. Yeah. I mean, I think as a leader of men, that's a great thing. As a guy who doesn't want to get fired, it's maybe not as great.
But I do agree with that. I think that you're right, that if Carson Wentz struggles, I think it will be less focused on Carson Wentz and more focused on Frank Reich. Although some of that applies to what happened in Philadelphia last year. Obviously, Doug Peterson got fired. There are a lot of stuff written about Doug Peterson supporting Carson Wentz too long, not benching him fast enough. But yeah, I think you're generally right. I think it'll more fall on Ballard and Reich, and especially Frank Reich.
Yeah, I think, see, here's what I think about Philadelphia. The difference between Indianapolis and Philadelphia is, Philadelphia has so much hate. They have enough to spread out over the quarterback, the coach, and the GM.
They can hate many things at once.
All at one time. I think what will happen with this is, if it goes horribly awry, the hatred will go toward Reich, and then Ballard, and then Wentz. And it'll be a step down on each one. Because Chris Ballard will get a little bit, again, this is just, I hate talking about this, because it's like, oh, what if it goes terrible, who's going to get crushed? And I think it'll be more Frank, and then Chris will have maybe the shield of, yes, I traded those picks, but Frank told me it was a good idea. Like, it wasn't my idea. Again, Chris would never say that. I'm not saying he would, that Ballard would go that direction. I'm just saying that's the way it will be perceived. And then Wentz will be, well, it wasn't really Wentz's fault. Wentz was broken. We knew he was broken in 2020, and this is the guy he is now. So again, that's kind of the way, again, like Rivers, if Rivers had gotten benched, and I don't think we would have written that. Like, I don't think the beat would have focused on Rivers much longer after that. It would have been like, yeah, he was washed. They were wrong. And then we'll crush Frank and Chris for ruining the Colts season for trusting the wrong guy. I think that's the way it would have played out if it did. But again, that's just my instinct. Again, I could be wrong.
I think that's a good point.
And again, it is like we have talked about this. This is a I don't think it's a highly risky move, but there's risk. It's a gamble. You are gambling a year of your franchise's livelihood, lives on Carson Wentz. And that's a lot of responsibility for the GM and the coach to take on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's inherently a gamble, but anything they were going to do this year was going to be a gamble.
Totally agree.
Anything they were going to be able to do this year was going to be a gamble, because I'm going to stick with what I've been saying. I don't think there was a better option ceiling wise than Wentz after, like, once we had gotten past Stafford. Okay. But going and getting Stafford would have been a game.
Yeah.
Cause what you would have had to give up, what you would have had to give up makes it harder and puts, I think, more of an onus on Stafford to be transcendent in that area. If they were to move up and get a rookie quarterback, that's a gamble, because drafting a quarterback in the first round in the NFL is inherently a gamble. It just is.
I think Chris Ballard sees that as more of a gamble, because the way he says it is, if you miss on the first round, it sets your franchise back 3 or 4 years. This doesn't, by the way. Carson Wentz trade does not do that.
No, it doesn't, because they can legitimately, like Jeff alluded to this and you've talked about it before, but they can get out with just a $15 million dead cap hit. And everyone who's like, that's a big dead cap hit, I don't think they'll care.
Well, it's like,
it's less than half of what the Eagles took this year.
We've reset the mark on what a big dead cap hit is this year. Like Goff, what was Goff, 26?
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, 33 for Wentz. Like 15 will seem like pennies compared to those. So you can get out of that.
I think when Breeze retires, I think his dead cap hit is like a lot.
Yeah, and I think they're gonna ultimately be able to spread it out over 2 years.
They did something with the contract to spread it over 2 years, but it's still gonna be a lot of money. So
if the Colts, again, we're talking about if things go awry, but if things don't go well with Carson Wentz, they're pretty much out of it next year for $15 million in dead cap and maybe just a second round pick. It could be a first, depending on what happens. But I said this from the beginning, and I think Jeff kind of alluded to this. It's a pretty good roll of the dice for the Colts, given what Carson Wentz did with Frank and the price they paid to do it. To get him, it makes a lot of sense. And to your point, I think it has the most high upside return of the realistic options.
I'm very early into this. I'm trying to watch every snap of Wentz from 2019 and 2020. I'm not going to do 2017. I've been told enough times that 2017 doesn't count, but I'm just not going to care. I know you've watched some film too. Carson Wentz, I don't think was great in 2019, but he did get a pretty flawed Eagles roster to the playoffs.
Yeah, he did. He dragged a team there that didn't have a lot in terms of weapons and a great defense that year and a few other things that weren't great. I actually haven't looked over the Eagles like 2019, but they were 4-8, right? Were they 4-8 heading into December?
Yeah, this year. Yeah.
No. Last in 2019. I thought, didn't they get in?
Last year. No. They got in it. They got in at 10-6.
Oh, they were 6-6. For some reason,
were 6-6, and he threw 10 touchdowns, no picks the last four games.
Yeah, in December. Yeah, yeah.
His overall season, he had 4,000 pass. He's the only quarterback in NFL history to throw for 4,000 passing yards and have no receivers with more than 500 receiving yards.
Yeah.
Which is kind of remarkable. So I think there's a chance that if that's the version, flawed as it is, I think that might be pretty good for the Colts.
Yeah.
And again, I know we've said this before, but we know from talking to people within the Colts organization that the Colts think that they're getting more that version than what happened in 2020.
You and I were both off by one, by the way. I just looked at their 2019 schedule. They were, they finished 9-7. I thought they finished 8-8. And you thought they finished
9-7.
They finished 9-7. So yeah, he did though. As you pointed out, they actually went 4-1 in December because they lost on December 1st. But then, as you pointed out, the most important part of this, which is they won four games in a row, all division wins. By the way, beat the Giants, beat Washington, beat Dallas, beat the Giants. So clutch situations where he comes in huge. And those four games, he threw, seven touchdowns with no picks in those games. And then if you include all of December, it was 10 touchdowns, one pick. He actually played really well in a 37-31 loss to Miami. So, Carson Wentz has shown the ability, like you said, to drag a bad team to the playoffs. This will be, there's no question in my mind that the Colts, again, despite the story I wrote today, calling them not Super Bowl contenders. And again, there's context there, but
I don't think that's so far over the line though. No.
I hope so.
It's not like, I don't think that's a hot. I don't think that's a hot take from you. I think the hot take is saying that acquiring Wentz immediately made the Colts Super Bowl contenders.
Yeah. Well, you were the one that kind of put the idea in my brain of saying, like, we have to grade, and you've said this before, but we have to grade every move on 0 to 100. Like, zero, it's like they're the worst team. Like, I think we've heard Mike Tannenbaum say they have the worst quarterback in the division and they're going to be terrible. And then it's a desperation move. And then you have other people like Dan Orlovsky, whose opinion I expect a lot, say that's going to be, that's, they're Super Bowl contenders immediately. And when I hear that, it kind of makes me mad. I was, and this is the lead of my story, but when I hear Carson Wentz makes the Colts Super Bowl contenders, I immediately expect to hear that Patrick Mahomes retired, that Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills lost like a bunch of players and they're not good anymore. I went over this with you. I sent you a text yesterday. I thought this was a good one. Like it's not just the Chiefs who have won the AFC Championship 2 years in a row. The last time they played anybody in the playoffs. So we're talking the Steelers, the Ravens, the Browns, the Titans, or the Bills. The last time they played all five of those teams, they lost 0-5. So I don't want to hear that they're Super Bowl contenders yet when they haven't beaten any of those teams recently. And when they don't have a left tackle and they don't have a corner yet with Xavier Rhodes being a looming free agent, and they don't have any defensive ends because they're all free agents. They don't have a move tight end yet. They have a lot of work to do. Let's just let this offseason play out before we start going Super Bowl.
Jim, that's not how the NFL works.
It's frustrating.
I've been told this my entire time covering the NFL. This is not how it works. We make decisions in February, and those decisions are final.
I know it's quarterback. It's the biggest move ever. Like, it gets the biggest move a team could make. But, like, just give it a minute. And also, teams that acquire a new quarterback almost – like, Tom Brady breaks every rule ever. He's the exception to everything. But teams that their first year with a new team, not usually Super Bowl teams. Almost never.
Yeah, that's generally true.
Usually you have to have established something for a few years.
Like, it's hard sometimes. It's hard sometimes, I think, from our perspective, because a lot of times, and this happened to me, I think, when I first wrote about the Wentz thing. Because I wrote about the Wentz thing before the report of two firsts came out. And I essentially wrote that to me, the question that mattered to the Colts wasn't what they were going to give up or any of that stuff. It was, can he still play? Like, is he still good enough to play? And if he is, we should go get him. And in the like 2 hours after that story, after I finished that story and it posted on the internet, there was a report out there that the Eagles wanted two firsts. And I was like, when I wrote that, I was not thinking that two firsts was a possibility. So I wasn't saying two firsts. And sometimes we have to write against like the perception, I think, that people are hearing from SportsCenter or hearing PTI or Around the Horn or whatever Stephen A's show called. I think sometimes you have to temper that. Like, when you and I sit down to write a story about Carson Wentz and how he could work or not work with the Colts, I don't think we're thinking about like in terms of Super Bowl. We're thinking like I'm writing it right now from the perspective of, does he play well enough that the Colts don't take any steps back, which is what Jim Irsay said he wanted. Like, yeah. I haven't even gotten to the taking steps forward part. I want to see if he's going to like, I want to see if he can play it like at or around the level Rivers played at this year. Then we can start wondering about whether or not they can take the next step.
That's the thing to me is like, I don't think people understand a couple of things. One, how good Philip Rivers was last year. And then two, how big of a monstrous turnaround it would be for Carson Wentz to play at that level next year. his numbers are, I mean, it's insane how bad he was last year. Like it's hard to put into context. Like he ranked 34th, 35th, and 36th in just about every quarterback metric you'd care about. Like he was awful, 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 awful. Like 6 yards per attempt. That's a stat we know Frank Reich cares about. Philip Rivers was at 7.7. Okay. That's completion percentage. Philip Rivers was at 68%. Carson Wentz was at 57.4. Those are huge leaps he has to get up to even get to Philip Rivers, let alone a challenging Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen. Like, let's slow it down a little.
I had this thought the other day, and the podcast is a good time to bring this up. If Carson Wentz plays well next year, he might get himself in the position for a very rare award in the NFL. Okay. he might be in position to win the comeback player of the year, but not for an injury.
Yeah, that's not usually a good sign for the previous season.
Which does happen. That does happen. Fun fact, Drew Brees won the comeback player of the year award. He did not win it after he almost lost his shoulder. He won it 2 years before that when he played well after being terrible the year before. So it happens every once in a while. And obviously it depends on, like, is there an Alex Smith situation? Is there a player who's coming off of a devastating injury?
Right.
But if Carson Wentz plays at Phillip Rivers level and there isn't a Alex Smith or something like that type of thing, he could be one of the few guys who gets the comeback player of the year award, not because he was hurt or anything, but because he just played better than he played a lot better than he had the year before. It's a very rare thing. You'd have to have more time than I have right now to look back and see how many times there's been a comeback player of the year that was for on-field performance only. Brees is the one I know because that's who I cover.
I like that you're thinking far enough into the future about awards. Like when you said, if he plays well enough, my first thought was the Colts might have a quarterback for 2 years in a row, the same guy. Like, it's insane how that hasn't happened. This is number four in terms of, I know if you do the week one thing, I think Scott Tolzien started the first week of week one in 2017. Brissett played the most of that year though. But it was Luck all of 18, Brissett all of 19, Rivers all of 20, and now it'll be Wentz for 2021. Like, that is wild, by the way. And if the Colts make the playoffs, you shouldn't underestimate the job Frank Reich has done and Chris Ballard has done building that roster, because making the playoffs, if they do 3 out of 4 times with 3 different quarterbacks leading the way, is maybe unheard of. I would think maybe not done very often. Did you find your stat?
No, I found the most recent edition.
Who is the most recent comeback player of the year award?
Ryan Tannehill.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Ryan Tannehill won in 2019 he had a shoulder injury a little bit in Miami the year before, but he played 11 games and essentially he won the comeback player of the year award in 2019 because he was much better than he had been in Miami. So, like, it's just one of the things that popped it. Like, if you guys think you're thinking a lot about what Carson Wentz might be in Indianapolis, that's a window into Jim and my brain. Like, we were trying to come up with all possible scenarios, like, already.
All right, so let's wrap this thing up because people have been listening to Jeff and to us talk for a long, long time. Biggest conclusion, I guess, and maybe it's something we already talked about, biggest conclusion from talking to Jeff, what did you learn that you didn't necessarily know about Carson Wentz, I should say, before talking to Jeff?
I think the emphasis that Jeff put on the very end, and it's partially our fault for asking all of the character questions that people have been wondering about, but he's not a bad person or bad teammate.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff out there about that he might have to fix, but it doesn't mean he's like this awful locker room cancer bad guy. Which I think, depending on what you read, you could start to think.
I think that's a great one. Mine is this. I don't think I had, and again, I'm aware of the storylines. Like, I've watched from afar, but I don't think I was, Jeff was like, we can't lose perspective on the incredible highs and insane lows that Carson Wentz has gone through in his career already as a young man. I mean, he's a young person doing this in the NFL, like, to go from like North Dakota State to the number two, where the Philadelphia gives up everything to go get you at number two. You are the golden child in Philadelphia, a city that doesn't often shower people with like that much love. And you live up to it. Like, the first year wasn't great, but year two, you're incredible. And you lead the team to the Super Bowl. And there's that high, you're a Super Bowl, you know, possibility. And you might win the MVP. And then you tear your ACL. And then you have to sit there. And Jeff told this great story about asking Carson Wentz why he was like kneeling on the ground after the Super Bowl. And Carson Wentz told him, I'm praying I won't be jealous. I'm praying I won't be jealous of Nick and of my teammates for doing this without me. And to have to go through that as a competitor and as a quarterback, that's so tough. And then he goes the next year and he's playing well, but he's looking behind him again. And then Nick Foles comes in and replaces him again and plays really well and takes the Eagles to where, you know, a playoff game. And that's really hard to deal with. And then He has the concussion that ends 2019. And then they draft Jalen Hurts. Like, the highs and lows this guy has gone through already in his career, I don't think we can overemphasize. It's just, it's a lot for one guy in one short career so far.
I think one other thing to just mention here is that, like, some of those feelings are not that unique to quarterbacks in the NFL. Andrew Luck, I referenced this earlier. Andrew Luck admitted in public in a press conference that he was jealous of Jacoby Brissett when he got back. And Jacoby didn't win a Super Bowl. You know what I mean? Like, Aaron Rodgers has admitted that the Packers drafting Jordan Love have made him start thinking about how he probably won't end his career in Green Bay. Like, it's hard to come up with somebody who should be in a more secure place than Aaron Rodgers. And Green Bay drafted a quarterback and he's thinking about his future. Like, that's, I think that's one of the things that maybe fans don't understand about the NFL, that I think you understand if you really listen to these guys and talk to them on a weekly, daily basis, is that every single person in an NFL locker room is terrified they're going to lose their job all the time.
Right.
Even the best players in the league are constantly thinking, well, at what point is this up? At what point is the team going to say, I don't need you anymore?
Yeah. And it's not only that, but it's also, it's that piled on top of this is their living. Most of these guys are living their dreams and they're worried about having not just their jobs taken away, but their dreams taken away. And they're, you know, like I said, livelihoods, but it's a lot. It's kind of crazy to think about, again, him being 28 years old and all the things that he's kind of been through in terms of career. I think if you stacked all those things together, you would, and you didn't tell anybody who it was, you might say the guy was 35 and not 28, just how much he's already been through as a person. So interesting. Like I said, I'm really glad we had Jeff on and to talk about that, because I thought that was some great insight for a guy who covered him his whole career, knows Frank Reich, and had, like I said, great, some of the best reporting, I think, coming out of Philadelphia on this whole situation. So I'm glad you guys got a chance to listen to him. Hope you enjoyed the second part where we kind of talked about what we learned from Jeff. And yeah, like I said, we'll be back probably next week, I would guess. Joel, I mean, we got to figure out where we're at, but I mean, Frank Reich's going to talk to the media today being Wednesday. He's going to talk to the media on Thursday. He's not going to be able to really talk about Carson Wentz, though. He will talk about his new coaching staff. So we'll have that.
I would say I'm just guessing here, but I think Jim and I will probably be at least on a weekly rotation here for the foreseeable future, right?
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. Like,
probably up until like the very end of March, first week of April. We'll probably have a podcast every time. And if you don't have one, talking to you, Nick Moore, who always gets upset when we take time off, it's because we went on vacation.
Yeah, just taking a little time off here and there, try to squeeze some in, be good dads, things like that. So,
sorry, Nick, couldn't help myself.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening to Cover 2. We'll be back, like I said, next week, and talk to you later.